Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health.
There is a particular kind of confusion that happens when your child likes their teacher. If you've ever thought to yourself, but she's so lovely, why isn't this working? Then this is the episode for you. Because today we are unpacking something very uncomfortable. And that is the gap between teacher intention and system capacity. Bronnie Hammond-Vale is autistic and has ADHD. She was diagnosed late at 35 and has worked across New South Wales and Queensland education systems. She has taught classes made up entirely of ADHDers. She has helped open a school for disengaged youth and is raising neurodivergent children herself. Bronnie really understands the tensions from both sides of this, the parent and the teacher. Bronnie, I'm really glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. This is a highlight of my career, having this conversation and being able to talk about something I am so passionate about.
I'm just having a bit of a giggle because this is the third time we've done the introduction. Bronnie said it was the highlight of her career. That was before I lost all the audio. So now we are an hour and 40 over, which is actually not the worst I've ever done. Let's jump right in. One of the reasons that I really wanted to interview you was because I wanted to get experts that have been in the education system but have also got neurodivergent children themselves. And what I really loved about your guest entry form was when you talked about how you deeply cared about neurodivergent children and students, but the system wasn't flexible enough to fully accommodate them. What do you mean by that specifically?
So it's really difficult when you have a neurodivergent child in your class and you know that there are resources and things that would really help them a lot, but you are constrained by your own department's budgeting or the time that they want you to put in. And so it's really hard when you are really passionate and you have a child who is neurodivergent and you are actively want to engage with them and in their learning, but in some cases you are almost stopped because the department can't manage it or the resources aren't available or they're too expensive or we can't be spending that much on one particular child, which I have seen across a number of schooling systems where that's the case. And the teachers end up just spending their own money to get the resources because they know the fundamental impact in the classroom. Some of these resources would be amazing for all the other neurodivergent students and even the neurotypical students. So I have seen that, and it is frustrating when you're advocating and you're wanting the best for this student, but you are being stopped because there are red tape or just inflexible rules or someone who just doesn't really see it because they're not in the classroom on the ground at that moment.
Oh, I think that's a really great point. My kids are at the best available option that we can find at the moment. We had to move regionally to find the right public school for us, which had a huge impact on our family. One of the teachers there who I love, right, hands down, fucking legend. And I like chatting to her because she's always up for a laugh. And she has one of my sons this year. He came home and was telling me about the fact that they have these wobble chairs. Mm. And the way that she does inclusion is she doesn't go, okay, well, stand into a line, everybody with a diagnosis. You are the only people that can sit on the wobble chair. Mm. She has an idea around, well, let's just give everybody who wants to go on the wobble chair a go. And then I thought that was really interesting because I was like, oh, but you've only got one wobble chair. How will that work? Mm. I asked her and she said to me, really interesting. The ones that need it are the ones that keep signing up. Mm. I let everybody have a go, but you find that the kids that don't need it will just sit on a normal seat. Yeah. But by taking it away and saying they can't use it, they all want to.
Yes.
So anyway, my son comes home and he says, we can only go on the wobble chair every like 2 days, let's say, because there's a list of other kids that want to do it. It's the start of the year. Yeah. And I said to her, what about if you had two chairs? Like, would that work for you or would it make it more difficult with the rostering system that you've got to control it? She goes, look, I love two chairs. We only have enough for one chair in each classroom. And that's how it works for us.
Mm, yep.
So ADHD mums, we donated a heap of wobble chairs, we heaps of sensory stuff. And I just did it because when I went home and I thought, well, these people are underpaid. She knows how much they need it. And this is really, I suppose, a reflection of this episode because the teachers, a lot of them, I think, are trying their bloody best, but she doesn't have enough chairs.
Yep.
Is that what you see?
Oh, absolutely. It's what I see. I was at a school in this special education unit. We needed more resources and we had a budget and we had stuck to that budget, but the needs of these particular children that had come in to year seven and were now in year eight were higher than what we obviously knew. And we weren't allowed to have more money into that budget. They then go and give all of this money to football and the sports and all of this when they didn't need new uniforms. The uniforms were still good from last year. They didn't need new equipment, but no, they were given that budget. And if they don't spend within the financial year or whatever it is, they lose that amount. But it's not about, well, the humanities have a little bit of surplus funds. Let's go send it to sport. If they have the surplus funds, they have to spend it, because if that department doesn't spend it, they don't get it allocated for next year when they might genuinely need a whole new supply of sports equipment or a whole new supply of textbooks for the humanities. And so when we needed new things and we weren't able to get them because there wasn't money within the budget, but there was heaps of money in the sporting budget, but they had to spend that money, leaving us with having to basically fund it ourselves. So I was seeing teachers' aides and the teachers in this unit spending their own funds, who already had children, and at the time many of them were single mums, but they knew the impact of having some of these physical resources were going to A, make the child's schooling experience really good for that particularly, but also knew that it was going to help them as well, because they were going to have regulated kids. They were going to have kids who are actively engaging in their learning. So it actually makes their day easier as a teacher's aide and a teacher.
Like money well spent.
Money well spent. Yeah. So it's frustrating. Yeah.
So then when we're doing PNC, right, where does that money go then? Because I was thinking, why are the teachers then buying things? Couldn't the PNC donate?
For example, for my daughter's school, the PNC run or help run the OOSH and the canteen and the Mother's Day store, the Father's Day store, things like that. They do also help raise money for things like new instruments and stuff like that. But I haven't ever heard of it being able to assist teachers. And I have actually told the other mothers that I hang out with, all of whom are neurodivergent, all of whom have neurodivergent kids, we really need to get on the PNC, because my school put in a ropes course and it was funded from a grant and maybe from some of the PNC money. I'm not entirely sure, but this ropes course, I have never seen it used. I've seen it used 3 times. My daughter has never been on it. A number of the kids have never been on it. So they've got this beautiful ropes course and I'm thinking, we don't have enough resources for the kids in the classroom who are looking for fidget toys and things like that. We don't have that, but we've got a ropes course that is not able to be used because the staff have to be certified and the students have to go through a safety course to be able to use it. What the hell did we just get a grant to spend money on? Like, I don't get it. So this is kind of what I'm seeing, that they are spending money on things that I think they will feel will help the school, but I don't know if they're actually getting into the classroom and talking to the teachers and asking, hey, what would make your room experience or your classroom experience or your students' experience better for the day? It may happen in some schools, but I am not seeing it in the schools that I am dealing with.
That's really interesting, because I wonder with when they're getting a grant, whether it has to be used in a particular way.
Yeah.
And so maybe they're going ropes course, tick start, and that's great, right? Because like, would you like a ropes course or nothing?
Yeah.
Yes. But then my question is, if we are seeing things being spent, like you talked about sporting equipment earlier, the ropes course, I've seen a very amazing sandpit pirate boat at one of the kids' schools that I was at. There was a public school. They didn't have any books in the library, but they had this pirate boat that was half made.
Yep.
So I get it. But then my question is, well, maybe the grants aren't supporting neurodivergent kids. Maybe the grants need to be sensory tents, wobble chairs.
Yep.
What is it that your school needs? Because if the school had the choice, and I'm giving the schools the benefit of the doubt, right? I'm sure there's schools that aren't managed particularly well. Yep. Most of the principals I've seen are pretty onto it. So I don't know if it would be like, here's 10 grand, what do you want to buy? And they get the ropes course. I think it might be more of like, there's actually no funding. There's no grants for the sensory stuff. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. So there's a level of rigidity in what grants and funding and schools can spend things on. There is also a level of flexibility, but you have to know what the flexibility is, and you have to have the right people in the power helping make those decisions. So the principal actively has to know what's occurring in the classroom on a ground level. My experience in the last 2 years indicates that maybe it's not, but you really need to be having people who are in the classroom, on the ground, in the grassroots, making those decisions, not people in a level of power who are slightly removed from the day-to-days of these children's learning and engagement and these teachers' teaching. I'm seeing that there is more support neurotypically for things for that rather than the very bottom where there's neurodivergence and needing like fidget toys and spinning chairs and standing desks and things like that.
So we look at funding because that seems to be a common denominator. For example, I have seen many times a lot of very intense sporting equipment that maybe doesn't get used all the time and then teachers paying for things themselves. Is there not the awareness that kids really need it? Is that why the physical resources are not there? Or is it a lack of education? Like, why is it that there's still a gap at getting some very basic things?
I think it's both. A play therapist recently said to me, and this is a generalized statement, if you are in the grassroots of stuff and you're at the bottom, you are less likely to progress up professionally because you know you can do more at the bottom. But if you are going higher and higher and higher up the ladder and you become into a position of power where you can make active change, they're not seeing what's happening at the bottom, so they're not necessarily actively putting the funding where it's needed or engaging. But it's also, if you've got someone up here who doesn't have lived experience or understanding of neurodiverse families, then that makes it a little bit harder for them to relate to what's happening down here. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think that really comes back to the flavour of the episode, isn't it? Because it's about if the teacher really is trying their best, they're, especially some of the passionate graduates that are coming out, and they're like, tell me, show me. And they want to learn.
Absolutely.
But if fundamentally they don't have a sensory tent, they don't have a sensory tool, they don't have a wobble chair, I think it's really unfair to expect them to buy it themselves, bring it in and then give it a go. Yep. Like, where is the system in supporting that teacher to support the kids well? Because as parents, we see the product of that, which is it not going great with the kid.
Yeah.
And the teacher seems like they're doing a great job, but you're like, this is fundamentally not working.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I do. I do. I fundamentally agree with that. It really breaks my heart that that's the truth, but that is the reality when we have such rigid and inflexible systems, usually because they are government-based. There is a level of inflexibility in relation to mainstream schools. You get a bit more, obviously, within independent and with private, but fundamentally at a bottom level, mainstream schools, government schools, there is a level of inflexibility within it that creates difficulty for teachers who are coming in passionate and engaging and literally soaking up information like a sponge, will go out on their days off, on their weekends to do professional development, to learn about neurodiversity. It may not even count to their PD hours, but they will still do it because they know that will make them a better educator and it knows that the outcomes that the kids will have in their classroom will be way better. It breaks my heart.
So when we talk about educators, and we'll try not to go too much into professional development because that's a whole episode, but if we have teachers that aren't necessarily getting the training within school hours or getting the point in the direction of, hey, this is how you would have a more inclusive classroom. Hey, you've got a lot of ADHDs this year. These are some tricks that I use to keep them on track. Then I think we run the risk, and that contributes to the narrative around neurodivergent children choosing to be badly behaved because you may have a teacher that actually just fundamentally doesn't understand. Mm. I met a teacher and I walked in really wanting to like her. And I walked away and thought, I don't really like her, but it's not about liking her. She might be a good teacher. As time went on, I became pretty clear that she was neurotypical. And then within this neurotypicalness of her, she really lacked the understanding of why a child couldn't just sit and listen and just do what they're told step by step. Mm. Like, I've just told him, why can't he do it? And from her understanding of the world, like, I get that because being neurodiverse and living in a neurodiverse world with all my friends and family, I have no understanding of how these neurotypical people can operate their lives. Like, what are they doing over there? It's weird. I avoid them.
Yep.
Right? And then I realized that's what she thinks about me and my son, probably. Like, well, why can't he sit there? Why does he need the wobble chair? She didn't even get it out. She just put it in the cupboard because, like, why do they need it?
Yeah.
And that's not her fault because she was actually passionate. She was actually a good teacher, right? But she could not understand why he needed it. And then we ended up with this bad behavior narrative. Mm. So
The reason I'm backing into the question in a weird way is on your form, you mentioned your brother and that he was labelled quite defiant as a child. And I'd love to talk to you about the myth that is existing everywhere, I think, around why are there so many neurodivergent kids now? They just need a good smack. We didn't have them before. No one needed Ritalin. And look how great we all turned out. And in your position as being an educator, being in the system, and also having a brother that was labelled that way and being neurodivergent yourself, what do you think about that?
So let's go back to my brother's day. We're both 90s children. We're 15 months apart. But he was labelled defiant and naughty and not listening. And that was due to not having enough education around ADHD. There was also a narrative that it was just boys and that it was solely behaviour-based. Coming into the 90s, we lost the use of that punitive punishment. And so they were still seeing the behaviours, but I guess they were struggling with them and having to label them. So they just labelled them as naughty and disobedient and not listening. And I am still sadly seeing that today in some of the narratives that I am hearing from parents and even just the words when I go in as a substitute and I'm hearing a teacher say, oh, you've got this student, they just never listen. And I'm like, maybe I think you might have a wrong idea about never listen. Maybe there's something else. And it turns out, yeah, no, there absolutely was something else different. And I had a great time with that student. We need to change it. Language matters.
Yeah, I agree. However, if I take the position of the ADHD myth person here, I would imagine that they would say, yes, but Bronnie, what about all the explosive behaviour? What about the punching, destroying classrooms? No one had Ritalin.
Yeah.
The speaking back to teachers, the disrespect, the swearing, the escalation of behaviours has come up. Do you think that would have been there without the punishments?
Absolutely. The experience that I have across a broad range of socioeconomic areas, as well as disengaged youth who have massive amounts of trauma, I am telling you that if you are using punitive punishments like caning and like yelling or excluding by kicking a kid out and things like that, those punishments are quite severe. And we now know the research behind them that caning and flogging a student, and as a parent, flogging your own kid, it is going to leave a more permanent trauma mark on their brain, which is they are going to take into adulthood and affect them in adulthood and potentially then go and affect their children. And the reason being that we didn't see as much back then was because the punishments were so punitive and were quite horrible. Like there are some stories that you hear like my own grandmother was caned because she wrote with her left hand. My own son writes with both hands. And I could never imagine hitting his hand to say, no, you have to write with your right hand. It's because the punishments were quite severe and in some cases quite traumatic and we now know that, you know, that's why we weren't seeing it. They were just too bloody scared. And I don't think, having worked in education as long as I have, I know that fear is not a motivator. I know people say it is, but it is not. Not for children. It is not a motivator. It will impact them. You may not see it then and there, but I guarantee you as an adult into their adulthood, it absolutely will.
Oh, I agree. One thing my mum would always say is, wait till your dad gets home.
Yep.
And when she'd say that, I'd always think to myself, oh, so I can do it. I just got to make sure dad doesn't find out. So is it really deterring them from the behaviour and intrinsically wanting to do the right thing, whatever that is? Or is it just scaring them to make sure that they manipulate, secret it up, do it on the sly?
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
I absolutely would agree with that. If you are saying to a child, wait until your dad gets home, okay, we're just going to get sneaky about the cheeky behaviour.
A lot of the time, as parents, we get told what not to do. And we know, the research shows, smacking, for example, doesn't work. Mm. I haven't seen or heard a parent that said to me openly, I smack my kid. Like it's generally, I believe, unaccepted. I think the smacking still happens, but people don't talk about it.
Or it's quite behind closed doors. Yeah.
My hubby and I have talked about this for a long time because he comes from an era where he was caned. That's just what he did. That's how you deter behaviours. And he has been on his own personal development journey that we all go on as parents, right?
Yeah.
But the gap that we had together was he's like, okay, so I can't do all of this. So what can I do?
Yeah.
And I believe that there's a gap with parents still around this, like connected with your kid, listen to them and all of the things, but where to hold a boundary, how to hold it, what boundary to pick. I think there's a massive gap within parenting, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of us know all this stuff we can't do, but we don't know what we can do, right?
And I really think teachers are in the same position. They cannot put hands on, and we don't want them to.
No.
They cannot do the timeout. They cannot exclude. The war charts don't work, right? Well, then how the fuck do they run a classroom?
When I had my first daughter, I was so into it, trying to find someone that I could do exactly what they do with all of my kids. But fundamentally, there isn't the one thing. And when I have three, all neurodivergent.
Yep.
So when one would kick off, one would run.
Yep.
All the parenting fucking connected books don't fucking work.
No, they don't.
When you've got one up on a bike driving somewhere else, one on the road, and then the other one running into the beach.
Yep.
It's just pure safety. Mm-hmm. And whenever I get upset or frustrated with anything that happens at school, I go back to how difficult it is for me to have three children on a weekend and how difficult it must be for them to have 30.
Yep.
And then we have all this stuff around what they can't do, but there's no fucking PD on what they can do, right? And I don't even fucking know myself because I struggle with parenting. I absolutely am not in the parenting space. So when we have teachers that really want to do the right thing, but your child is still struggling, where do you think those gaps are?
So there's a few things. You raised a really good point. As a teacher, you're right. We are very explicitly told what we can't do based around research and things, but you're right, we're not filled in on what we can do. And I think there is a gap. It's through professional development that is run by neurodiverse teachers who have been in the classroom. I am sick of seeing professional developments where the person hasn't actually worked in a classroom. They are basing it off academia and things like that. Absolutely useless. Unless you have been in that classroom, you can't do it. Being a teacher, I know that it is difficult in the classroom. If you have 30 kids in a classroom, it is at times mayhem, but I think the best thing that you can do is actually be open to it, be open to everything, and not seeing something, an adjustment or a slight change, as a criticism to your teaching. Or when a parent suggests, hey, could we have a standing desk at the back? And it doesn't impact you. Like, you might think, oh, well, I've got 29 other students who are going to be upset by that. It's not about that. Having the adjustments in the classroom and adapting slowly, because a good teacher, an amazing teacher, will adapt on the fly. If you are a teacher who is unable to do that, then you need to be going and doing way more study, because you need to be able to adapt on the fly. Sadly, we're rigid as teachers that we have to get through this curriculum. The curriculum can look so different in so many different ways. It's not about just sitting at a table. Is the student doing the work, but they're sitting under the table? Then what's the big deal? Because you don't think it's normal or the right way doesn't mean that it isn't. And so I think, yeah, there is a massive gap in professional development. I will always need it, because that is how I'm going to grow as a teacher, as a person, as a human being. I think there is a rigidity in education and teachers, and when they're at university, that it has to kind of look a certain way. And when it doesn't, we think we have also failed as teachers. But if your student got the outcome, what does it matter how it looked? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Oh no, it totally does. One of my friends recently said to me that they believed the best teachers were neurodivergent, right?
I fundamentally 1,000% degree. Sorry, I'm just going to say that. Or they have neurodivergent children, or they have neurodivergent friends. So go make a neurodivergent friend if you're neurotypical.
Neurodivergent people don't want to be friends with them.
Yeah, that's true.
If a neurotypical said, you can't be friends with
you, you'd be like, fuck no.
Yeah, I agree.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. No, I was having a laugh. Like, what the fuck should we be friends with?
Yeah,
So my friend made that statement that they believed the best teachers were neurodivergent, right? When she said it, I was like, oh, yes, I agree with that, because they probably have experience themselves, they're easier to communicate with, they get it. Yes, that's an advantage. But one thing, I woke up 3 o'clock this morning, I started to think about, is it that they have experience? Is it? Or is the experience that is so critical the problem solving? What you were talking about on the fly. Let's say I had a couple of neurotypical friends that I was friends with and I kind of drifted away from. They're living in a different world. Their kids get out of the car, they take their beach towel, they walk to the beach, they get in the water, they get their towel. Their mum says, get your thongs, they get the thongs, they get in the car. It's a different fucking experience.
Yes.
I am problem solving. The dogs run off with the thongs, the other one's gone through and picked up a snake.
Yep.
One of them's found a friend, they've gotten on a bike, they've run off. Mm-hmm. Like, I am constantly problem solving. Then my hubby will ring me, I'm supposed to have an appointment, where is it? Like, none of us know what we're doing. Then I have to go, oh, I don't even know where I've parked the car. Where did I put that? Like, oh, my petrol's flat. I don't know where the nearest petrol station is. It's a constant baptism of fucking fire every single day.
Yep.
And so then I wondered, is it the neuro divergent self, or is it the problem solving that the neurotypicals don't have?
Actually, I kind of think it's half and half. I definitely think the problem solving is massive. As an adult who is neurodivergent, the level of problem solving that I have to have in my day-to-day life is astronomical, because it's just how we have to function. I can change a lesson on the fly with no resources. I have walked into classes where I've been told, hey, you have to give a chemistry lesson. I am not a scientist, and you have just told me that I'm giving a year 11 chemistry lesson and there's no resources. And I was able to answer the questions, but it was just because I was quick and able to do it.
Oh, I love it.
So
if we look at professional development, I have a friend who's a teacher, and she said to me a while ago that when they do professional development, exactly what you said, let's say a psychologist, they come in and go, this is the brain. They fucking know all that, the teachers.
Yeah.
What they want to hear is about is, okay, when Johnny's going over there, going running in circles, Mary's crying, and Simon's run off to go find his mum down the road, what do I do then?
Yeah.
But all of that is missed. Mm. And I think if we could take the flavours of the neurodivergent teachers that we love, and maybe it is the on-the-fly problem solving, because even if they're not naturally able to do it, right? Because why the fuck would you learn that skill? It's draining, that skill. But if we could teach them scripts, exactly what we used to do with the neurodivergent people, we teach them to mask to become typical.
Yeah.
Why don't the neurotypical teachers, if they are trying to connect with neurodivergent kids, we show them what it would look like, what would work?
Yeah.
This is your toolbox.
Yep.
Like, this is what I have had to do with my hubby. Firstly, you need to look at the three children, there's always one that will start.
Mm-hmm.
When he starts running in this circle to the left, you got shit happening. You got to feed him. He doesn't know he's hungry.
Yep.
I've had to script out for my hubby what to do and what are the red flags before he rings me and says, shit's gotten real fucking bad. I don't know how to get out of it.
Help.
And it's like, did you feed that kid?
No.
No.
You're past it.
Yeah.
It's
and,
not
I'm like, and he's like,
now.
Oh, he said he's not hungry. Of course he's not fucking hungry.
Yep.
Because you missed the window.
Yeah.
So if we could pull out the parts of the neurodivergent teachers that is teachable, how do we pull that out and teach the neurotypical teachers?
So, yeah, it's a really good point. They do need a toolkit. And so when I've gone into a classroom, the school I worked at a couple of years ago, I helped open this school for disengaged youth. Let's just say that level of what's going on in that classroom is massive, and there are like 9 things going on at once, and little Johnny has run up the road. Simon is setting the classroom on fire and Mary is in a puddle on the floor. So I was on staff. I gave the social workers, here, try this. Here's the script. And they taught me things as well. We had scripts and activities and things that we could say in those moments and notice the cues, and it can be done. And it does need to be done as a professional development. Sadly, I think a lot of us neurodivergent teachers are in the classroom and aren't doing those developments, or the schools aren't seeing it as money for value, because sadly, the education system sees that the academics are the more important aspect. I will say, though, that my daughter's school recently do a teacher professional development, and one of the teachers asked me about it. It was about restrictive practices and when they can be used, how they're used, what's safe, what not. Now, I think that is very important. As someone who has had to sadly engage a restrictive practice in a classroom for the student's safety, my own safety, and the students behind me, I ended up getting very badly hurt. But the reality was, in that moment, it was needed. If you are a mainstream student, you are not usually using restrictive practices. But as you said, we are seeing more and more things happening. The teachers don't have enough tools in their toolkit. And so I was like, that's a really good start. But hold on, we probably need to go 4 steps back, where you did a PD on an autistic girl doing masking in the classroom looks like, because that is fundamentally very important, because it is impacting them and their daily lives. We need to understand that behaviour is a form of communication. You need to be learning that. They need to be doing professional developments. I'm sick of hearing the rhetoric that behaviour is, oh, they're just naughty. Hold on a friggin' second. Did you miss the 3 cues back where he was so dysregulated, but you kept talking at him? Like, I would be pissed off at you, and I'm an adult, and I have to restrain myself from throat punching you. But like, that kid restrained too. His response was, I'm removing myself from this situation. I'm taking myself away and walking out of the classroom. That is labeled as truanting. I literally had this situation where a girl was removing herself from a classroom. She is old enough to know that violence is not okay. So she removed herself and got in trouble for truanting on multiple occasions. And she was literally saying, I'm removing myself because I could see that I was rising. Now, that's insightful for a 15-year-old.
If that was my daughter, I'd be pretty proud.
I was so proud. I said that in the meeting. I was there as an advocate. I said that in the meeting. I'm proud that she walked out. I would want her to walk out. I know that there is safety and duty of care that mainstream schools have. I know this. But why are we being rigid? If I have a student walk out and I had to just have a little bit of a, hey, I'm a little bit upset with you. You've been on your iPad. You're not engaging. What's going on? And they've gone, I'm done. Dad had a nasty hissy fit at me last night. Mum had a hissy fit at me this morning. You were the tipping block. I'm walking away. Now, my duty of care would be email the office, maybe send a friend with them. Hey, could you just go with her for a second and then come back and let me know where she goes? Just make sure she's safe. I don't need to be making a big deal. What I do as a teacher, I will go and talk to the students afterwards. I will go, hey, we had a really bad lesson today. Is something going on? Because behaviour is communication. And I have literally had a student say to me, hey, my mum passed away a couple of days ago. And I'm like, oh, shit. Like, that's massive. Can you imagine? You've got a kid there who's still coming to school because they want to engage, but it just, as grief comes in waves, and it was coming in that moment. And I wasn't necessarily seeing it. I knew there were things going on, but I didn't know the level. But having that repair as well, that is another thing that could go in the toolkit. Having repair with students. I have said sorry to students. I have not seen the teacher go, hey, I'm really sorry that I was a bit snarky with you today. I didn't eat lunch. I was in a bad mood. And I have said that to a student. And the repair that makes is massive. And it's a tool. It is actually a tool. It's a tool that we use as parents. We are taught in parenting that if we have these moments that we are to repair them, because it's teaching them to acknowledge when they've done wrong, and it's teaching them that we as adults in power acknowledge when we've done wrong and that we're willing to repair. That is another tool that teachers could be using, but they're not.
Yeah, I agree.
What you're talking about is a broader toolkit.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you connect and manage children, any child, without corporal punishment?
Yeah.
What can we do? And then we're building intrinsic motivation. We're building a child that will grow into a teenager that we'll walk past rubbish, for example, and pick that up.
Yeah.
They're not looking around going, oh, there's no teacher looking, I'm not going to bother picking it up. We're looking at building different motivation.
Yeah.
We are going to have to finish up. We've only gotten about a quarter way through the question. But I really wanted to thank you for your time, because every one of our guests that we've got on has got both lived parent experience and teacher experience. And the burnout that you would have on both sides of your day would be something that I cannot fathom, because when I walk into the school, I have a feeling that I need to run away. Mm-hmm. Like when I drop my kids off, I physically want to get the fuck out. It's overwhelming. The amount of needs, what I'm looking at, what I'm seeing, I'm like, I actually have to go back to my little podcast room and sit in the quiet. Mm-hmm. And I really want to acknowledge the hard work that you would do on both sides of that. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I'm so blessed that I was able to talk with you. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And we will catch you for the next episode on the internalizing masking, which we will do then. Thank you so much.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.